Dardrill 14. We were talking about the early days of the assault on the Gothic line in late August, I think.
28, 29, something like that.
That's the period, yeah. And we were talking about the evacuation of casualties. Who supplied the vehicles for the medical side of things?
This came from the main carrier station. They had what we call blood wagons. They were the box-type ambulance. We had jeep ambulance working from the RAP. It would take three stretchers, two lengthways, one across. And they would work back to main dressing station, clearing station to main dressing station, and from there, of course, back to hospital.
Could this system cope with the...
Well, most of the time it did. There were times, for example, Germano, it couldn't cope then. In fact...
We'll come to Germano, we'll talk about then, yeah.
But most of the years, it coped quite well. We had an excellent MO. He'd been with us in North Africa and he came with us all the way until he left when we were in Greece, I'm not sure. Anyway, Hugh Morris Jones, a real Welshman, splendid chap. Hugh Morris Jones, got an MC, and he died from cancer 10 years ago. I still write regularly to Gladys, his widow, and he was the moving spirit on the whole thing. He had a Nurse Griffin, Sergeant Griffin, known as Nurse Griffin, excellent fellow, just the right man for the job. I had two full corporals, each of whom got an MM, two lance corporals, and 12 stretcher bearers, farmed out to the companies, and in each company there were men trained in first aid and as supernumerary stretcher bearers, because you needed more than two quite often. And then they worked from jeeps, from the RAP jeeps back to field clearing stations. The system worked quite well, and I don't recall there being any serious problems on that. The difficulty was getting casualties in. That was a big problem. Quite often they were in exposed positions and impossible to reach them. And men must have died for want of care. I mean, there's no doubt of that. Germano especially. Anyway, to come back, Mortiano, we had two or three days rest, I think. Yes, I think it was something like that, 2 days anyway. And we went on then to... Well, Monte Gridolfo itself had been largely evacuated. Monte Busso, which was the big one that we were worried about, was completely empty. They pulled out completely because they were coming up both sides of it. It was huge thing. They pulled up because they were outflanked. And the next thing that I remembered was really the Tumano Ridge, which was a nightmare. It's a battle honour of the Barons, incidentally, Germano. It was a sharp ridge that ran from east to west. It was totally exposed. The whole of the front of the area was rising ground. And I'm not sure of the name of the river. There was a river there, Conca. Can't remember that. And you had to cross the river before you could get onto the approaches. There were some sort of galleys, which were some sort of protection, but not very much. And 139 Brigade was given the job of moving up there. And I can remember the foresters and westers went in. And they had a lot of trouble. We were sent in. I came up that night, and there was nothing but jeeps coming down all the way, passing us with wounded, a lot of casualties. And one of the worst features was Germano, when you began to get onto the slopes at night time, of course you couldn't move by day, it was fully exposed. Although some Hampshires, they did. They moved at daytime, and this happened for it, but they gained their objective. And there were a lot of assaults by daytime, but we went by night. We were fortunate, perhaps. And we got repulsed. Jumano Ridge, it took, I think, 6 days, 5 or 6 days to overcome the resistance from Jumano. And there were wounded, dead, lying out for 3 weeks. The padre told me that he'd come up, because he used to come up very regularly in burial parties and so forth. And he worked with the medical officer. They used to share a tent. The Roman Catholic party was there too. Quite curious. Our party was called Meek. Ed Meek. He's still alive and there. It was rather amusing to have a man called Meek and a man called Fury. Our Fury, of course, was Irish, 16th stone, quite forward, enormous chap. Ed Meek, a little man with chiseled features like George Arliss. Anyway, they were great friends and they used to. I think they did each other's work.
You mentioned, yeah.
Anyway, to go back to Jumano, it was eventually a flank attack which got around the back of it, which caused the resistance to come to an end. But I'm sure it was 5 days before anybody could get foot onto the Jumano Ridge.
What was it like for you in your job?
Well, it was very difficult. Couldn't get the food up. Because the whole of the area, Jumano was a commanding ridge, and you could see everything in front of us. To get any rations, to get ammunition, you say, the RSM had great trouble getting ammunition to them. Because they were in these galleys. And the galleys, of course, were fixed line targets for night time. People Jerry was firing from the ridge at night time. Regular intervals, more or less. Because he'd spotted the likely lines of approach by day, and of course he'd marked them and got his elevations right, and he was firing at night time. Very difficult to get food up there at all. We were certainly on the dry rations then. And I don't think it was even compound in some cases. I think it probably bully beef and biscuit, and some hot tea if we were lucky. Tommy cookers were issued. This is the thing with the solid methylated spirits. Rip open the top, the fire match, and you get a colourless flame, almost invisible. You boil up with your mess can or a pot. Most people have a pot by this time. We have become, since we landed back in the second time in Italy, we had lost a lot of our, what I might call, regimental. The going had been quite hard, and most people have acquired small comforts. I remember seeing people who'd got leather jerkins. Well, they weren't standard issue leather jerkins, they were leather jerkins whipped from some farmhouse or other. And they went, the weather was turning, the rain was coming, and people were eating off China plates and so forth. Not in Jumano, but we had become less regimental, both in dress, appearance, not in morale. Morale was good and strong, very, very strong. The great advantage of the Middle East break was that we'd had reinforcement and people had got to know each other, and all the officers knew all the other officers in other countries. Most of the warrant officers all knew each other well. We'd had a corporal's mess, they all knew each other. We'd had NAFI, we'd had ENSA and so on in the Middle East. The troops got to know each other. It was a good feeling. It was strong morale.
Do you think Jumano changed that, though? I mean, did morale dip Jumano a bit afterwards?
Smashing, yes. Morale was not good after Jumano.
You could discern a difference, yes. Could you?
Well, first of all, it took so long to overcome. And the casualties were really very heavy. And there was a Hampshire attack from one flank, and the Durhams had a very hard time, but they actually got into Jumano village. And well, that was house. That was street clearing, house to house. Collins was very prominent in that, I recall. His great house clearer, Collins. He had his, he always wore full weather equipment with big pouches, which were designed for rain gun magazines, but he always stuck his full of grenades. He was a great chap. He'd crouch under a window and pull the pin and hold it for about 8 seconds and then lob it through a window, nip round the front there and catch them as they came out the door. It was great. It was known as Winkler for that reason. It winkled people out. Did the same thing with machine gun nests.
What was he like as a chap?
He was a regular soldier, regular officer. He was a lieutenant at that time. Later commanded carrier platoon. But he was with C Company then. A small, fairly short fellow in the build. He retired as a lieutenant colonel, OBE MC, and he's living down in Devonshire, and we see him every year at the reunion. And he was a great man for street clearing, house clearing. It was a speciality of his, and he used stun grenades sometimes. But I don't think he ever used phosphorus. We didn't use a lot of phosphorus.
Why not?
Well, I don't know. We used phosphorus for setting fire to foliage. It made a lot of smoke. It was one good thing. If you had a lot of, especially if it was semi-dried, if you put half a dozen phosphorus grenades into that, it would get a really good rolling smoke across and you could go through it. Very helpful. But I don't remember people using phosphorus grenades much. Smoke grenades, stun grenades, and high explosive grenades, but I don't remember phosphorus much. Except that I remember, well, the Pioneer Platoon used to have a good supply of phosphorus grenades.
What? Why them in particular?
I can't remember. I remember they did have them. I don't know what it was for. Although, concerning the Pioneer Platoon, did a great job.
Oh, I meant to ask you, now's a good time. What would they be saying something
well,
like Germano?
Actually, you might call them lay sappers. The Royal Engineers, of course, were working all the time, night and day, because everything had been blown everywhere you could go. Roads, passages, every bridge had been blown. There were diversions. Few of these rivers justified a bailey. Most of them had pontoons. And our chaps worked with the Royal Engineers on construction. Emergency construction jobs. And a hot time they had of it too. And quite a few casualties when they were trying to ford river, put pontoon bridges across rivers for transport. They were very much frontline troops in this phase of Italy. And we had a bearded platoon sergeant, you know, they're entitled to a beard. And they had the cross axes on their shoulder, stripes, Pioneer Sergeant. He did a good job, and he had a platoon of...
Do you remember his name?
Parker. Sergeant. Well, they had two of them. One was Salmons, one was Parker. And they did a very good job. There were 20 or 22 men in that unit. They were working all the while. They were never got much in the way of relaxation. They used to repair, when you got stuck somewhere, they would come up and build you a sort of dugout. They were good at dugouts. What the Americans called foxholes. And they would go into the side of the hill, and in no time at all, they'd got struts up. And many of them had been miners. It was easy work for them. They knew about struts and ceiling supports and such. And they used to, particularly for battalion headquarters, they used to build dugouts. Well, they were shellproof. They would be fairly shellproof, with several feet of soil on top. And after there was a slight air of depression in the battalion after Germano, because it had been very costly and it had been frustrating, And although it went down as a battle armour, and it's on our list of armours now, it was a sad occasion. We lost people, lost family friends. And one of the worst features of the Padre told me, he said that he tried to bury people, but there were some bodies. He said that he buried the last one 3 weeks after the action started. He just couldn't get at them. They were in the ravines, and I'm afraid some of them must have died for want of evacuation. There was no way you could evacuate them, not even at night. There was a fixed line firing with the light machine guns with tracer was coming down all the time.
So your role throughout remained the liaison and supply.
At the next place we got to was San Alessio, and I was there one night with a ration truck and a water shell, wounded both the company commander and his second in command, and they were evacuated. I stayed on, and I stayed there for about a week. I radioed the colonel and told him, and he said, you better stop there, get them together. So I did. I had a week at San Alessio, and I remember the old quartermaster. The quartermaster was a great man. He was a regular soldier.
This is Newman.
Newman, Bert Newman. He was a regular soldier, had been to the army school, joined as a boys' service at 14, but he was no man of letters. And he could never get his tongue around these Italian names, and I always remember. I said, well, where are you going, Bert? Sugi Mugi. Well, this was the closest he could get to San Alessio, Sugi Mugi, but I knew what he meant. I stayed at San Alessio the week for about a week until they brought up, I think, Darcy Steed. I think he took over the decamp, Darcy Steed. And I came back to my own job.
That's after Germano, is it?
Yes.
Yeah. After Germano, they went down to three companies, or three rifle companies, didn't they?
Had to. Most battalions did. We weren't alone in that. It's a matter of casualties.
So what about, there are a couple of officers we haven't mentioned much. Major Mitchell, who was with A Company.
He lost his foot.
R.S. Mitchell.
Yes, Ray Mitchell. He died 10 years ago. Ray Mitchell stepped on an anti-personnel mine, and so did his number two, Dick Hewlett, who lives in Goring, near Worthing. He's still alive. Ray Mitchell died. His Ray had his foot blown off, an anti-personnel mine.
That was at La Crocetta?
Yes.
Or Croce?
Well, La Croce, Santa Maria della Croce, I think, or as I remember.
What was he like, Mitchell?
He was an artist, a commercial artist, and a very gifted one. I remember in the early days, when we'd finished the African fighting, he used to do caricatures. He had worked for Punch at one time, but he did a caricature of the Brigadier. I don't know why, the Brigadier had been a bit harsh.
Block.
He used to say, you must be robust, you must be robust. And well, he overdid it at times. And I remember Ray Mitchell drew a caricature of an Egyptian pharaoh with the full headdress and the little snake going up and so on. And obviously bringing Brock's face. And underneath he'd written in, and they came unto Pharaoh crying, why treatest thou thy servants thus? And he said unto them, thou art idle, therefore shalt thou have no straw for thy bricks. This was this found its way to the brigade mess, deliberately, you know, so that Briggy Rock could see what the Durhams thought. And that was Ray Mitchell. He was a very brilliant artist. And in fact, he did quite a few sketches of actions and the locations. And the colonel used to use him. He used to say to him, well, Ray, go up there and give me a sketch of it. And he'd come back and he'd only got chalks. And he'd have a dark brown white and stretch out. Very gifted man. Anyway, he was a company commander and he stepped on a plenty personal mind and he lost his foot.
What about Charlie company, Casey?
Pat Casey? Oh, no, Charlie would be Sherlock then, wouldn't it? Yes.
Well, it says Casey. Yeah, I think Sherlock comes and goes a bit.
Sherlock was wounded twice.
Yes. Well, what was Casey like? Because I heard he had problems in the later days in Italy.
Casey was a moody man. He had problems in Greece, I know, but I didn't realise he had too many problems in Italy. But he was because he was moody, he was not popular. I know his company's Armada had a bit of a session with him at one time.
Who would that be?
A fellow called, I think it was Skelders or Skelders Dale or Skelders something like that. Can't remember now. But I know he had trouble with his company's Armada. He was a perfectly sound man at his job. I mean, he was a good company commander, and tactically he was excellent. But he was moody, and one minute he'd be up, the next minute he'd be down. The first company commander of C Company had been, of course, Newcastle University Pat. Not Pat. Oh, never mind, forget it. And then it was getting worse and worse.
It's all right.
His names, they jumble up in my mind. Pat Casey was dark. He was a fairly stout figure. He was aged about a bit older than us, at about 30. And he had Ray Mitchell had D. Alan Hay was A company. We were down to three companies after Gamardo, because I think I'm right in saying that in the 16 or 17 days from the Toro to after Gamardo, the average loss by each infantry battalion of the 9 infantry battalions, 200 men each. So the casualties have been close on 2,000, which is a lot for an infantry battalion to lose. So we certainly, and we weren't alone. The Hampshires were down to three companies, Foresters were down to three companies. I don't think the Resters were. Can't remember now.
Now after Germana, it's Laurie Stringer's book says you pull back to Verrucchio.
Yes.
I don't know. And there. There's a reorganisation and an effort to provide entertainment for the troops.
Yeah, Verrucchio was a resting place, really. I would say licking the wounds, really. I can't remember a lot of entertainment at Verrucchio. Among my many duties was president of the Regimental Institutes, PRI, also PMC, president of the Mess Committee.
What did that involve? Let's talk about that.
President of the Institutes is the man who has charge of the peace conditions of the NAFI, the Corporal's Mess, the Sergeant's Mess, the Officers, the PMC does the Officers' Mess, it's the same cap. He has charge of all entertainment, troops' welfare, and things of that kind. At Bolivia, I can remember, we had tea and wads. As PRI, I had some funds, not a lot. Tom Reynolds was with me at that time. Tom was second in command of B Company, later became company commander of B. He and I quite often used to work on this PRI. But we had flour, we had sugar, we had fat. And we had the cook sergeant used to knock up buns, which was. They weren't very good. They had a handful of raisins. If they could raid some farmhouse somewhere, you could find sultanas or something like that. There were no sultanas in Italy because of the grapes. And There was, and we had tea and wads, I remember. I think there was a mobile cinema that came up. I can't quite remember. The Verrucchio was not so far back. You had trouble with 5.5-inch cutting.
One thing they mention is the battalion dance band called the Bandwagon. I mean, it says it did a grand job of work at Verrucchio. Yeah. Were you aware of them? Do you know much about the band?
Well, I formed it, yes. They were called the Melody Aces. I've got a picture of them in Greece, but there was a divisional dance band. I think that's the one that came to Verrucchio. But we had the Harmony Aces, but this is later, this was Cesena. Yeah, you're quite right, it was the divisional dance band. What are they called?
The Bandwagon.
The Bandwagon.
Well, yeah. Were they popular, that sort of band?
Well, we very rarely saw them. I know they entertained the Gunners quite a bit. The Gunners had a more fixed life than we did. After all, they had portees and guns to pull, and they mostly more on roads than we were, so they had more activity. I mean, we had a wonderful woman called Nora Rashen, R-A-S-C-H-E-N, Nora Rashen. She must have been the only woman in the forward areas, but she used to come up with a tea wagon, and quite a remarkable person. It was a Red Cross. And Nora Rashen was in charge of her wagon, and she used to brush aside objections by various senior commanders that it's not safe for you to go up there. But she'd go, you know, and she'd turn up, and she'd find her under some overhanging cliff or something, and she'd open up, and she'd say, "Well, send your chaps down two at a time," and so on. They used to go down there, and she had a small amount of chocolate, a few cigarettes, and she had a lot of buns and tea. Nora Rashen, amazing woman. There were quite a lot of photographs of Nora Rashen taken with the troops, particularly with B Company, I remember. Laurie Stringer, if you asked Laurie Stringer about Nora Rashen, they were good friends. Anyway, after this Verrucchio.
Now, while you were there, you also got drafts from various places, and not many of them seem to have been Durham's.
I mean, they weren't. We became very much a sort of. A mixed battalion. We got a lot from artillery, like, because a lot of gunners, ACAC gunners, were being stood down because they didn't need them to the same extent. Air superiority having been gained, and this is true all the way back to Egypt, and quite a lot of ACAC gunners joined us actually in Casasin. We had some join us there because they didn't need it. The Mediterranean was free of air attack. And so there were a great many anti-aircraft gunners who joined various infantry divisions. We tried our best to make them feel at home. We tried to keep them together when they came to us so that they weren't broken up. They weren't very pleased about being downgraded to infantry. Obviously, they felt that a certain part of the ubiquitous artillery, you see, they were superior. After all, right of the line, the artillery. Right of the line. And they didn't feel very happy about coming to infantry, and we had to make them feel at home as best we could. And we did this by pep talks and so forth, and they couldn't understand what the Durhams were talking about for a long time. There was always that language problem. But little by little, they settled it. And they did a very good job. They picked up the idea pretty quickly, and they settled in. After all, later it was a question of survival, so you learn really quickly then. But we did have a lot of fellows who came, and we lost them too. I can remember some of our chaps going to the Lincolns who'd been badly hit. And we lost some fellows to the Lincolns. But there were a lot of chaps joined us. In Verrucchio, we went back to four companies again. And the next thing that I can remember was the advance on Cesena. And this was an unpleasant business. It was a brigade attack, and we never had a lot of success to begin with. The river